Finance and Policy Committee for February 17th. It's about 1:05. Thanks for your patience, everyone. We're just getting everybody set up with our laptops here. We have a little change in the agenda. Chief Executive Benjamin is unable to make it today, so we will try to fit her in on, I believe, next Tuesday. So we have Mr. DeKramer, and before we go to that, I think what the commissioner did last time was fantastic with a little overview. And if she doesn't mind doing that again, I'll turn it over to the commissioner to introduce her board members.
Thank you. I almost said Chair DeKramer. I've got two chairs in this meeting. Thank you, Chair Drayheim, and members of the committee. It's good to be back. My name is Jennifer Ho, and I am the commissioner at Minnesota Housing. I know that you, senators, were all here for the last meeting, but in case there's any members of the public who were not here Tuesday that are here today, I just wanted to take a moment to explain that Minnesota Housing is unique among state agencies because we have we're a governmental entity that's independent from the rest of the enterprise, and we're governed by a board of directors. The way that the statute is set up is, as the commissioner, I have administrative authority, but the management and control of the agency is vested with the board. The board includes 7 members, 6 public members appointed by the governor and the state auditor, Julie Blaha. For purposes of financial management and bondholder obligations, housing finance agencies around the country are often separate entities under the authority of boards. I just want to say personally, I feel very lucky as the commissioner of Minnesota Housing to have such a strong board of directors. It is a volunteer board, and they do an incredible amount of work. They meet 12 times a year plus committees, and oftentimes I send them board packets that are 200 pages or more of detail about the financing of various projects. And I am super lucky that when I stepped into my job, Chair DeKramer had been in that role for some time. And so with that, I will stand here and be available as needed. But Chair Drayheim, I turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I guess with that, Chairman DeKramer, it's to you.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator. Introduce myself, I guess. John DeKramer. I live in Marshall, Minnesota, down in southwestern corner, for those of you who may not know exactly where that's at. I think what I recall some of the questions is, part of your questions is how in the world it end up on this Minnesota Housing Committee. So I'll give you a little bit of a background on that. I kind of ask myself that same question at times. Magnetics design engineer, and one day I was kind of thinking, you know, I got to do something other than just look at numbers and get involved in something with the city. So I ended up signing up on the EDA locally here in Marshall. I hit that about the time after working with the Business Development Committee and then onto the EDA, working on one of the larger housing projects in Marshall, where we put up, set up a whole new neighborhood and a little over 100 houses with several apartment buildings in the city, primarily for Schwann's at the time. That got me into deciding, maybe crazy, but ran for city council. So I am presently yet on city council after about 14 years. That also got me into as an elected official as to be a board member on the local community action board. And with that, ended up on Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, which was actually started by several CAP boards. And spent a few years there on the board, and somebody suggested I put your application in for Minnesota Housing. So I did that, and back on 2012 was got appointed to the commission, and somewheres along that line ended up as chairing. So I've been chairing for a few years now. So it's kind of my background in that. I've maybe take a little bit different perspective on things than some other people, being kind of on the technical side and just backing into it and seeing from the ground up, you know, trying to work on housing. So I think maybe the easiest for me, at least anyway, is if any of you have any questions, I'm ready to answer whatever I can. So, Senator,
thank you.
I'll turn it back to you.
Yeah, questions. Thank you, Chairman. And you know, we do have some questions we're asking all the members. But I'm going to turn it over to Senator Deems first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you, John. Thank you for what you do, not only on the board, but actually a lot of what you do for the city of Marshall. In that community, you've been a real strong asset for the community there, and we certainly do appreciate it. Do have some questions, and the first question I have, John, is what do you believe the MHFA does well to promote home ownership, I'll get that right, and what do you feel it could do better? So we'll start off with that.
Oh, okay. Let's see. What do we do good as Minnesota Housing for home ownership? Really, it's in my mind, it's taking people from the very beginning. Keep in mind, you know, if you've got some money put away and you're able to get commercial loan, you're probably not going to be talking too much to somebody from Minnesota Housing. You might reap some of the benefits of what we do, but probably not using all the services. Where we really work at is trying to work with the people that are, you know, maybe borderline or below the line on credit scores. How do you build those up? How do you get that going? Get them into through our home, I would call it a home training session, like, okay, this is what it's like. What happens when you buy a home? Because that can be scary and financially dangerous if you don't do it right. Bringing them through that with some classes and training, and then from there on, helping support the first-time home buyers with financing, down payments, a variety of things that way, and getting them to the spot of purchasing a home, but not just leaving them there. We hang with them for a while and make sure they're really getting through the process and getting themselves set up to actually be a homeowner. I think we all know that's a good way of building wealth. Many of these families, some of them immigrant families coming in, do not have the financial wherewithal to get started. They don't have the moms and dads that are around with maybe a little bit of starter funds to help them get into a house. And so that's where we come in. We work with the people that are, you know, like you say, borderline on credit, to get them into the right spot, get them up and going, and help them hold their hand and through the process. So that's, I think, one of the things we do very well. You know, there's two aspects to anything on home ownership. There's, you know, I always think of, you know, the single family home. That's always to me, that's the optimum, but that's not for everybody. So we've got, we have to cover the full range of housing for everyone in the state, whether it's, you know, trying to find some place for somebody that's lost a house or lost a place to live and are now homeless, staying on somebody's couch or whatever. on through people who want to rent and are entirely satisfied with the rent situation. With apartments, affordable housing, the Section 8s, the really every aspect of housing on, I would, you know, roughly, in my opinion, kind of call it the lower half economic scale that people just, you know, you don't have the funds sitting in savings to back up on and have that ease of getting credit. So that's where we come in and really work with it. Hope that answers your question, Gary.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Chairman. Any follow-up, Senator Dames? Nope, okay. Senator Duckworth, would you like to go next?
Absolutely, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for you, sir. How often do you meet with stakeholders regarding MHFA's programming, and which stakeholders do you find that you're typically meeting with? Thank you.
Chairman?
Okay. Actually, I try to meet as often as I can. I know this year I was able to attend the Northeast Regional Housing Forum. Also attended the Northwest Regional Housing Forum, the Greater Minnesota, along with Minnesota Housing and several other sponsors were ever able to put that on. In the past, last year, I was able to get to the Southwest Minnesota Forum. It's been a while since the Southeast, so I've got to catch that one next go around. They don't have them every year. Along with that, I do meet with both individuals and groups on housing. As a matter of fact, and it'll probably, I get some time here a little later on in this conversation, I want to talk about the housing meeting I had yesterday with a group of realtors and construction and housing individuals that were locally here in Marshall. So, you know, a few topics there to get a chance to talk about if we can, because I think it's very pertinent to what we're doing here. So does that answer your question, Senator?
Thank you, Chairman. Senator Dixon has a follow-up, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to bite on what Chair DeCramer just said. First of all, thank you for your service. And my grandma, I believe, graduated from Marshall High School, so I am familiar with the area.
Okay.
I am giving you the opportunity because I think we have a housing crisis across the state. This committee has heard me say that many times. And I think how we address some of the housing issues in different parts of the state needs to be different, because what, you know, some of the way we address it up here might be a little different than, you know, in Marshall, Minnesota. So I'd like to hear the ideas of what you have and what you had discussed in the meeting yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Chairman?
Okay, just a couple of things. First of all, Senator Graham, you can just call me John. It's a lot easier than trying to figure out which chairman is talking about. So please feel free to just call me John.
Thank you.
As far as, long list of items on the, where we're at, we're obviously short of housing in, I would say, almost every area. Marshall is no exception, although, you know, we try to work on a few things here, of course. I know some, yeah, you know, like you mentioned, Senator, there's different needs in different areas. For example, we talked about one of the discussions when we had the Northwest Forum around the War Road area. There's housing that was put up for affordable housing, but yet the owner or the people running the home there, we're not able to fill everything up with people because a lot of the people were making more money above that due to some of the good jobs and the DigiKeys and a few of the other companies up there. Yet on you bounce to the, you know, the southeastern corner, it's another whole issue. Probably more some on the need for apartments, all those. Single family housing is a big thing. The Marshall discussion is, like I said, no different than many other ones. We've got probably, I think right now in Marshall, with about 2,000 homes, actually houses in Marshall, I think we've got a total of about 18 to 20 that are for sale. And not all of those are, I would say, of the standard that people are looking at. Virtually nothing in the 250 to 350,000 bracket that a lot of, you know, the upper end families, somebody moving back into the area may be looking for. Some of them are in the 100, 150,000. And just trying to get, you know, housing going. If I can put on my city council hat, for a little bit, you know, we've got lots in Marshall. We've actually got a lot of lots, owners, private owned, city owned, and we're trying to do what we can to get into it. But the cost of the lot, honestly, is a small portion of the cost. It's difficulty. There's difficulties in getting construction workers, getting materials, getting, and actually our discussion yesterday was a lot around, construction workers. You know, how do you get the people to do it? Getting a framing company to come in. You know, one of the construction guys was talking about, okay, if I can get a framer to come in, he'll do a house in 7 to 10 days. If my crew has to do it, it takes, you know, 2 to 3 weeks because they're just not as experienced or just not as ready to do it. So, but you know, our closest framing company right now is up by, I think it was up by Litchfield or Painesville, around in that area. So it's just a lack of people in the construction. There's the cost of it. There's, we tried to cover some of the things in zoning, or there's some zoning issues that we need to address locally. And I think, and that might be a greater concern in the metro area, but I'm not seeing or hearing that as much out of the greater Minnesota area. You know, that's another issue. We still need to have, you know, you still want to have parks, you still want to have streets and everything else, and all that, of course, costs money. So doing a lot, you know, we've got lots in Marshall that we're selling for $4,000 or $5,000 that are on fully developed streets, water, sewer, right up into it. And, you know, they're still slow on doing it. They can build a house and before they finished, it sold. Now we just can't get enough people to construct homes. That's one of our bigger things here. And kind of the same thing, I guess, I heard from, you know, the Northwestern region, you know, trying to just get workers in and get some things built. I don't think the land is an issue. I think we're just, you know, bodies and as much financing. I know from some of the things we're seeing at Minnesota Housing, jumping back to Minnesota Housing, you know, we've got, you know, the housing study that was done about 2 years ago. You know, the outcome out of that was there's, you know, there's a lot of people that are financially capable of buying. It's just getting the financing, getting the, and now with the cost of housing the last year going up, makes it a harder reach. So it's just a multifaceted problem, unfortunately. And there's no single pill or silver bullet that seems to help out on issue other than just trying to keep chipping away on it as much as we can. Probably a long answer to your question, Senator, but hopefully you get the gist of what I'm thinking. Here's a hearing.
Thank you. I think next we'll go to Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just can't call you John. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. But I do want to thank you, along as Senator Dame said, thank you for your service to your community, Marshall, and to the entire state and what you're doing here. It's very valid. I was just wondering your opinion on the rent help program and what you saw of areas that could have been improved and we should learn from Chairman? That experience.
Well, I would say one thing we learned is it's not exactly easy to give away about $500 million. There's a lot to it from that. The details on, it was done over two different funding streams, I would call it. The first one, second one, each one had different set of rules, some different auditing content. So that didn't exactly help the issue at all. Just getting a program set up of that massive size. I mean, we had, you think around the state, Marshall, we've got maybe 28 to 30 different languages that are spoken. State, there's, I don't know how many more you had in there. We've got to be able to do that for all the different languages. We've got to be able to get to each one of those groups that, honestly are, come from an area where they didn't exactly just trust government. So trying to build a little bit of that trust, working with partners that we can through the area. The first go around, the admin costs were not covered as well as the second go around. I think maybe they learned a little bit on that. So we had to do that a little bit, some skinnier margins with a trying to get that going, get away. You keep in mind, we did a little over 100,000 applications over the year. I think we issued something like 90,000 checks or payments, electronic and paper-wise, to the different entities, landlords, different landlords, some that had, electronic accounts that were set up, some that didn't. You've got smaller operators that are operating in a whole different financial scheme. So quite a bit of that is, it was a very complex ordeal with a lot of requirements from the funding. And then on top of that, with that much money floating around, we want to make sure that we're getting it to the people that really do deserve it and make sure that we're not giving to somebody that may be questionable and what they're really out after. Are they trying to skim the some of the funds or whatever? So it took a little longer to set up. What would we do different? That I would say that's a good question, because I'm sure there's quite a few things that we could have done differently when you look back on it and say, well, that would have worked better or could have worked better. Obviously the staff at Minnesota Housing would have a better answer on that. But from, I would say, my end of it, I think we handled it very well. I was watching what other states are doing as well. We're all kind of in this together with different states. We weren't the first ones with money out the door. We weren't the last ones with money out the door. We were kind of running in the middle of the pack. And it's, we tried to set it up as easy as we can, using as many partners out in the Minnesota that we could to get to as many different small groups. Just locally here, we have a fairly strong Karen population here, and just trying to get to that in a manner that they understand it, that this is available. So just things like that, it was quite an ordeal. It's great to see the money go out. It's great to see it happen, but this was quite a project. I'm not sure if there's a few people want to go back through it again. Hope we don't have to have that situation.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Senator? Yeah. Good. Okay, thank you. I just had a couple questions that weren't on our prepared list, and I know you were really involved in the community down around Marshall. And it sounds like you have a lot of existing lots already, so maybe you haven't developed any lots recently. But I was just wondering if you had any idea of the cost increase or decrease with the infrastructure going in recently on all the inflation, if you had any thoughts on that from down in your neck of the woods.
Now, well, as far as the city goes, we haven't developed lots for probably 6 years, 7 years. So I don't have a good direct costing figures on that. I know from the construction guys, the way we, the do it here with, here's the requirements, what you need to set up as a private developer. This is what you need to have ready for putting in the infrastructure. This is what we want for streets. And then you turn it over to the city to get it going. And that's just, I know from what all our street projects, it's expensive. It's about $1 million a mile for a road if you're going to do it right. The infrastructure, of course, is all sewer. We're pretty much in a flat area, so that's helpful in some areas, not when you're trying to run sewage downhill. So we're trying to, we have pumping stations, various things like that, that, you work in a pocket and you need to have a lift station put in. So, but as far as actually directly to your question, Senator, whether, how's that affected with the inflation? Other than knowing that the cost of PVC has gone up considerably, the lead times have gone up quite a bit, extended out there quite a ways. That's about the extent of it. I am on the liaison with the utility board, so I do get to see what we're doing there. And fortunately in Marshall, we've got a lot of our power underground. That's been a project for the last 10 years of getting that put in, because we tend to be a little windy around here, and trying to get that underground and away from the ice. So it's certainly not inexpensive to do. It's a costly endeavor to do the development. And honestly, I think that's part of it. Fortunately, the Marshall has got an advantage that, we've got some areas where privately have been mostly developed. They've got quite a bit of the infrastructure in, although, they have to run another block or two here for the next row of houses. And so it isn't quite so bad, but I know from some of the other cities, I'm just listening to what goes on in Jackson, for example. We've got some contacts down there. That's tough. They're having a hard time. It's they pushed their infrastructure for a time there. They had basically spent everything they could as a city to try and get infrastructure in and try to appeal the growth. So it's, unfortunately, none of this is easy.
So my last question would have to do with your location in regards to like South Dakota. You're kind of a border city. You're not right on the border, but you're darn close. What have you seen? What challenges has your community faced being so close to a neighboring state? Is there anything different that is challenging for your community to attract people and housing and growth?
Just attracting people is one thing. We talk about here in Marshall, we really need a freeway, yet I've got to remind some people that talking again with people down in Jackson, they've got a freeway, and it's so easy to run down the road and go work in South Dakota, or go live in South Dakota and drive into Jackson to work, or down in Iowa and come up. So, there's good and bad out of there. I don't think there's a business in town of any major size or significant size that hasn't got a letter, a call, or something from South Dakota, or actually a number of other states. I know personally, I've had letters from Texas. I've had several other states saying, come on down, come here, we'll do this for you, we'll do that for you. And the only, I would say the, I think right now, although like for us, South Dakota is, that's a big competition for us. Pulls a lot of people in that direction. And that, takes everything else along with it. The school kids, the housing, the whole works. The only thing I see out of there is right now they've had so much expansion and industrial growth, they're hurting. They can't come up with enough people. So, that means they've got to pull from elsewhere rather than trying to hit all these little towns around here. So they might go chase after somebody else. It's tough keeping, it's honestly tough keeping business around here. You see how many trucking companies that, for some reason they've got a South Dakota license plate on it. They're living in Marshall, they're living in the area, but, they've got that little post office box on the other side of the border, and that's all they license are trucks. So that's, just all part of it, things we put up with. I know we've had discussions, kind of rambling on here other than housing, but we've had discussions on how do we help the brain drain. Do we get people to come in by, paying their schooling, paying off their student debt, trying to get them in on jobs. So it's, if anybody can think of a trick, we'll think of it and give it a try. So. See what we can do.
Well, Chairman, I really appreciate your time and thanks for your passion on housing. I'm going to let you off the hook. Unless you have any closing statements, did anybody else have any questions, members? Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, if I may, and beg your indulgence here, but I would like to bring up one other item, and I may have my favorite housing commissioner run for the door in this one, but something that came up in the discussion yesterday that I'm well aware of, and Senator James, you and I have talked about this in the past too, so it's not going to be the first time you've heard this one, but I'm going to go back in one of the projects that Minnesota Housing had. We funded about 2 years ago some, I think it was five single-family residents that were to be built, a combination of affordable housing, workforce housing, and they're going to put it in Meeker County as where we'd like to go. That came through, came through the Community Action that I'm with now, UCAP. I'm on that board as well. But that was 2 years ago. As of yesterday, they still have not put a shovel in the ground. There's a lot of difficulties in trying to get the funding to work. One of the things that came out, and because I had a couple of the individuals that were involved in the same meeting that I was at, the prevailing wage issue in Meeker County ended up adding, the numbers I had was $60,000 a home from trying to do that. And there's no question that, people need a living wage. That's a definite. And the people that are building the house should be able to afford the house. But if there's any way, because I think it only can be resolved legislatively, is if you could look at the limits, in my mind, if you could look at the that area where the prevailing wage comes in, maybe niche out a little section that says, okay, if it's single family housing, we can raise the limit to 300,000, something like that. and then it kicks in. But for, you know, the five houses they're trying to do now, they're really working at it. They're trying to get them in, but 60,000 additional for the house is quite a bit. Because of its proximity to the cities, that's where mostly where they're tapping in on the getting the prevailing wages at. You know, for example, the plumbers, that's $75 an hour. So it's that's tough when you're out in, you know, in Meeker County. So if there's anything from your end you can do, and I think you're the committee that maybe has the most influence on that, I would raise that flag as saying, hey, can you help out some way or another?
I appreciate your perspective and you know, kind of a real life example. And this is an issue that we have heard about. And we did try to have a fix a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, we weren't able to come together to agree on that fix. Some of the ideas was a dollar amount, like you mentioned. Others were treated like they do financing. And if it's a fourplex or less, it's for most lenders, they treat that differently than a larger unit building, you know, five or more units, and just kind of have that classification from a Senate standpoint where those smaller projects would be exempt, because it's hard to find a contractor that understands prevailing wage, let alone to find a contractor right now. But I do have a question here in the room from Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chairman, I thank you so much for bringing this up. You and Senator Dreheim understand this issue very well, because Senator Dreheim lives this all the time too. You mentioned Jackson, and I'm honored to serve that area. And this is the number one issue that has, I hear repeatedly why they are not able to expand in their housing is because of this issue. The competition, they cannot compete, and they flock to Iowa. So a very attractive part of Iowa. But thank you for bringing that up, and we should continue to work on it. It is that it is one of the big issues that we have to get our hands around.
Yes, I, you know, thank you, and I hope you do, because and I know it, yeah, it's a complex subject and as well, and there's a lot of nuances to it. It's a contentious subject, so yeah, that's right. I see Commissioner's still on camera, so she didn't run away anyway. So, but we've had discussions on it. Like I said, Gary brought it up to you before and some things. So, yeah, I know you guys are aware of it, but trying to keep it on. That was the comment yesterday. If we could, you know, help on that, you know, maybe Meeker County, they might have it resolved, because it sounds like they may have to move it to Litchfield, but because they might be able to get some land in Litchfield for free. So that would help. But again, you know, you're talking 60,000 a home, lots in Litchfield or Marshall even, you know, don't go for that amount. Our high end is like 40,000. So
it's probably an helps, extra unit.
Doesn't solve it.
It's Pardon? Probably an extra unit. That if you take the 60,000 times the five houses, you're talking 300,000, and I'm sure that would build a home in that community.
That's another house. Yeah.
So we got to find a balance on that whole issue with prevailing wage, and we have tried in the past. Unfortunately, we weren't able to come together across the aisle to come to a solution, but we need to figure that out. So I appreciate your perspective on that. Members, we are going to move on. So thank you again, Chairman DeKramer.
All right, thank you.
And your insight. And feel free to reach out to us anytime. With that.
Okay, and again, if I can be of any help as well, please let me know.
Thank you. With that, folks, we're about halfway through. So I'd like to switch to the commissioner and the questions. If we could get someone to put those questions up, that would be wonderful.
Chairman Dreheim, can I just, in case my chair decides to leave, I just want to thank him for clearing his schedule to be able to be with us here today. And I think he demonstrated why it is I say I have an amazing board of directors at Minnesota Housing. Thank you very much for making time to be here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Commissioner. So when you're ready, Commissioner, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairman. It was a little awkward just managing the pronouns last time when I was trying to read through my own questions. So I think I'm not going to try to read the questions, but if they're up in front of everybody, people will see the questions that you have that I'm addressing, because I just had a hard time inverting the yous to me's. With some of the specific content that I have that is specific numbers or numbers by year or breakouts, we'll be following up with the committee in writing. But I just want to be able to talk through these to see if I'm getting the information that you requested and see if there's anything from this discussion that I should augment based on our discussion today. So starting with single family units constructed with housing infrastructure bonds between 2012 and 2021, I'd start by just noting that between 2012 and 2019, per statute, housing infrastructure bonds were only available to community land trusts for land acquisition, demolition, and utility connections. It was in 2020 that housing infrastructure bonds were expanded to include development and rehabilitation. And then in 2021, that was available not just to community land trusts, but to other entities as well. So if you look at the year-to-year breakout for all of 2012 to 2021, we've done 434 total units. That's 320 units of preservation and 114 units of or homes of new construction. But you really see an acceleration in the last selections. We did 88 units, 33 preservation, and 55 new construction in our most recent selections with the new uses kind of fully in play. And then obviously there were some years we didn't have housing infrastructure bonds at all. So there's a couple years that are zero. But obviously now as we continue to use both the new uses and the set aside, we would expect an acceleration of that over time. And again, we'll get the money over to you. You asked about the breakout between single family and multifamily. The multifamily rental does include the senior housing rental. And I think we sent over to you in writing, it's all a blur, sir, the single family specific breakouts in the written stuff we sent back before the last hearing. But the multifamily breakouts going back to 2012, it's 5,025 total, and that's selections. That's not completed construction, because there's a gap in time between selection and completion. The question was around completion. That's why I make sure that I pointed that out. These are selections. And then of the 5,025, 1,782 of those are preservation units, and 3,243 of those are new construction units. So of the 5,025, 912 are senior units going back to 2019. I think it's important to note that when the housing infrastructure bonds were created, they were really created to facilitate the creation of more supportive housing, to increase the preservation of federally assisted housing, to keep those federal dollars in the community, and then also to deal with acquisition and rehab of foreclosed or abandoned rental units through community land trusts. So it started with a very, very specific set of purposes that have then been expanded on at different points in time. So should I pause, Chairman, to see if there are any questions related to my answer to question number one?
Thank you. Members, any questions for the commissioner? I think we're good on this end here. Continue, please.
Thank you. So the question was about the amount that was selected versus the amount that was requested, and you know what that has to do with the pace of the creation of new units. So this specific set aside that was created for single family, first of all, is legislative available until January of 2024. And we anticipate selecting projects each year so for the entire set aside within that timeline that was created in law. The total requests received of 36.8 million, only 5.9 million specifically requested housing infrastructure bonds. And we selected 5.3 million of that 5.9, did I say 5.9 million specifically requested housing infrastructure bonds, and we selected 5.3 million of that. There are a lot of activities that come in on our single family consolidated request for proposal that aren't activities that could be financed through a tax-exempt housing infrastructure bond, such as down payment assistance. So not all the activities that the agency funds are housing infrastructure bond eligible. Yeah, I mean, the other thing that we do is we also utilize the state appropriated programs that allow us to do single family, including Challenge and the Workforce and Affordable Home Ownership appropriations. You know, they are actually easier for developers than trying to work with the more complex financing associated with housing infrastructure bonds and raising money on the capital markets for those. This is something that we've been in dialogue a lot with Homeownership Minnesota about. And then I think, you know, we've been working with many of the folks who do submit proposals on our single family side for quite a number of years. So part of our selections process takes into consideration the open awards that grantees have from previous year's selections. So, you know, it's not that if we don't fund the whole project, the developer necessarily could have completed based on historical production, the number that they put in the proposal. And so scaling back so that we are always trying to increase production, but we're also not having a bunch of previous awards out there where progress is slow or not being made. So we're really trying to right size an award to the capacity of the entity. And obviously different entities have different capacities or different capacities at different times, depending on how much they have in their pipeline. Happy to take any questions about question number two.
It looks like we're good, Commissioner.
Thank you. So number three was around the use of the word may. Minnesota Statute 462A.38 Subdivision 2 uses may, and the language in the report is meant to align with the statute. Any questions?
We had a phone going off in the room, I'm sorry. Can you repeat your answer on that, the may?
Yeah, so Minnesota Statute 462A.38 Subdivision 2 uses may, and the language used in the report is meant to align with the statute.
Thank you. Please continue. I don't see any other questions.
On question number four, on the percentage of funds that are derived from housing infrastructure bonds as grants versus loans. Under current law, housing infrastructure bond proceeds for grants can only be used for manufactured home community infrastructure today. So the vast majority of housing infrastructure bond proceeds finance long-term loans, oftentimes 30, 40, or 50-year loans. Should I go on to number five, sir?
Yeah, please, thank you.
What's the interest rate in terms of the loans? So typically these loan terms are 0% for 30, 40, or even 50 years. You'll remember that the purpose oftentimes is to make sure that when we do, for example, preservation of a federally assisted property, or we do a supportive housing project, or we do a senior housing project, we want to make sure that the project keeps the affordability that it agreed to at the time that it applied for the funds. The loans can take a lot of different forms and structures, really dependent on the whole package of project financing. There's oftentimes a pretty complex capital stack and the specific type of housing that it has. Minnesota Housing does not include an interest rate unless it's requested or necessary for the project. There's this unique aspect of the federal housing tax credits where sometimes the project requests up to a 1% interest rate on these programs in order to access the federal housing tax credit. So we just work with each project to make sure that the terms line up with what's needed to leverage the rest of the financing. So the short answer is that the agency does not earn interest on loans or grants financed through the housing infrastructure bonds.
If we can go back to three, I'd hold up the 462A.38 on the workforce and affordable housing.
Chairman, you're a little hard to hear, and I don't know if it's the double microphone.
Is that better?
That's much better. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that. So under 462A.38, the title of that statute is Workforce and Affordable Homeownership Development Programs. And then, the definition, a Workforce and Affordable Homeownership Development Program is established to award home ownership development grants to a bunch of different communities. And the purpose outlined in this section is for development of workforce and affordable home ownership projects. So I think that is the intent of that statute, is home ownership. I think it's pretty well spelled out. Now, the May part does talk about what the funds could be used for as a subcategory, subdivision two, in that, but I think it does pretty well spell out that it is intended for home ownership of some form. So we can discuss that later, but that's, and maybe we could talk to nonpartisan if they're on, if they have any thoughts on our interpretation of statute.
Senator, we largely agree. So figuring out how to make sure that we're reading the statute as intended, I think, and seeing if there's anything that could be improved, we would be happy to follow up with you on that.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner, you can continue.
I've lost track of where we were. Let's see. What happens to repaid funds? Question number six. So as of December 30th, 2021, just over $3 million has been repaid. Again, I'll point out that most of these investments are long-term loans, and they're long-term loans that are really intended not to come back to the agency, but rather to buy down the debt on the property so that it can be deeply affordable. So put that $3 million against the nearly $400 million in housing infrastructure bonds that we have issued. And then there was a predecessor going back to 2009 called the nonprofit housing bonds, which was kind of the predecessor to the housing infrastructure bonds. So many of these loans are forgivable. Very few have been repaid, as you can see, based on the amount. And then if they're repaid, the agency relends the funding within the housing infrastructure bond statute. And we recycle the money, which also then limits the amount of new debt that needs to be authorized to provide an additional loan. Should I move to number seven?
Yeah, let me just check. Any questions? Finance Chair, are you good? Hey. Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, Commissioner. So I'm fairly new to the committee. I'm wondering if you can give us some sort of perspective or context of how much of funds typically do come back. It sounds like maybe there's not a whole lot of some are being forgiven or not being repaid, but could you give us a sense of just how much in terms of dollars does come back to the agency where they can exercise discretion on how to reutilize them?
Chairman Dreheim and Senator Duckworth, $3 million had been repaid as of December 30th, 2021, and that is relative to $400 million that had been issued. So less than 1%, I think I can do that math, has been returned, but it's largely because it's intended to be tied up in long-term deep affordability of the rental units that most of this has gone on to because of the original purpose of the money. And then if the money is recycled, it's still recycled in a way that deals with the terms of the bondholders, since the obligation to bondholders continues on. That doesn't end.
Any follow up? Okay, thank you, Commissioner.
So the questions around the timeline between bond allocation, bond sale, RFP, and the funds becoming available for use, and when projects are completed. I will apologize in advance that this is not a simple answer, but I am going to try my best to give a thorough answer. So the timelines vary depending on the legislative language, the timing of the passage of the bonding bill, and other characteristics associated with each authorization. New eligible uses, for example, and state contingencies can impact the overall timing. It's also subject to the timing of the state's general obligation bond issuance and related financial disclosures. So Minnesota Housing issues housing infrastructure bonds as projects that have already been selected by the board are ready to be financed, right? So selections and kind of the actual act of financing, those things happen at different moments in time. So barring unforeseen circumstances and specifics in the legislation, here's kind of the rough timeline of what we would expect for the governor's 2022 capital budget recommendations. I'll take a moment to say if we got $250 million in housing infrastructure. The RFP opens in April of 2022. We would have new authority when the session ends the next month, May of 2022. The RFP closes in July of 2022. The initial developments are selected by our board, estimated in December of 2022. We would do the first bond issuance in the fall of 2023. And then the bond proceeds would be available to finance loans in the fall of 2023. And the request for debt service on the initial bonds issue would begin on July 15th of 2024. My understanding is that these timelines are very similar to what the state does for the general obligation bonds. So with our financing, our goal is to limit the amount and the duration of issuing housing infrastructure bonds in advance of project readiness. So basically you don't want to have an obligation to a capital investor. You've raised money in the private market, you have an obligation to them when you haven't put the money to work yet. So Minnesota Housing needs additional authority to select projects. Because we only issue when developments are ready, we only need the debt service when the cash is needed to finance the loan or grant. And, so there's several factors impacting the timeline, the pipeline and the readiness of the project, the financing and construction timeline of each project. Sometimes we provide end loans, which means that we're the last dollar in the development. Sometimes our money comes in earlier in the development. And then also the timing of the state's issuance of GO bonds. Currently the state only issues the GO bonds once a year. And we need that financial information as a part of the underlying continuing disclosure arrangements between the state and Minnesota Housing. That's necessary for us to issue the housing infrastructure bonds. I would once again offer to bring my chief financial officer back if you want to go into this in much deeper detail, but I'd be happy to take a stab at any questions if you have it to that.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. I think Senator Rosen might have a question or two.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Commissioner, we just had a review from Assistant Commissioner Hasmer this morning from MMB in Finance Committee on our debt service and the appropriation bonds. And I thought, not that I'm correcting you, I'm not saying, and I could be totally wrong, but I thought the GO bonds were in August timeframe. Appropriation bonds are more like October. They're a little bit later. But my question to you, you mentioned the governor's request for HIBs and $350 million, you said, or something. How does that equate, like in 2025, ongoing? What does that look like?
Commissioner?
Can you answer that?
Chairman, Senator Rosen, I think I need more detail on the question. The governor's proposal is $250 million in housing infrastructure bonds.
Okay, 250. I was off $100 million.
Hey, Commissioner, isn't it $250 per biennium for three bienniums?
Chairman, I think there's just one bonding bill in play.
Oh, I think the original budget, I haven't seen a revised one, but was $250 for three bienniums in a row,
right,
for HIBs. And that would add, I think, about $20 million a year to the debt service.
Right.
And then that would grow up to $100 million in debt service just for the HIBs portion of our budget, because we're at about $41 million right now. And I think if we took out the $750 over the next three bienniums, that debt service would grow $20 million per set of 250 HIBs, mm-hmm, so it would grow to $100 million, mm-hmm, in just debt service. Mm-hmm. So,
Chairman, the governor's proposal is for one new authorization of $250 million. That I know. The way that MMB incorporates that into the planning estimates is not my area of expertise, but I do know. I would remember if the governor was proposing $750 million of housing infrastructure bonds, I think my heart would beat even faster. It is a one-time request of $250 million in authorization, plus the $60 million in the public housing preservation, but those are GO bonds.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any follow-up, Senator Rosen?
No, thank you.
And again, would happily bring, I know he's out there listening, I'd happily bring Kevin Carpenter, my chief financial officer, back if we wanted to go into more of the details on the financial mechanics of the bonds. Let's see, where are we? Are we on?
Commissioner, Commissioner, I'm sorry to interrupt. Senator Port has her hand up. Senator Port?
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, if you want to see a bill for $750, for housing, I'd be happy to put that on your desk.
Thank you, Senator Port. Good to see you. I think there were planning estimates, I'm being told here by Joel, is that there would be more in the future. Yeah. So governor's recommendation, 250 in appropriation bonds for this request, also included our budget estimates of 250 for each planning period for 2024 and 2026. So that's how I got that extra the total of 750, Commissioner. So it'll be aligned by any means.
Yes, Chairman, so I think I would anticipate what would happen in future bonding years. I think that's, but I would have to have Commissioner Showalter come in because those are their planning estimates.
Okay, please continue on. Sorry about the distraction.
So I think we're on question 8, is that right?
Yeah, I think we're on, we just did the timeline.
Great. So question eight, how many housing infrastructure bonds, single family homes are turned into owner occupied homes versus rental homes? The turned over part of the question just had my team talking a little bit just about what the intent of the question is. So I want to just interpret the way that we read the question to make sure I got the question right. We finance, for example, a community land trust, and the community land trusts have agreements with the homeowners that set the terms of how they're owner occupied and what happens when they're sold. So to my knowledge, you would not, under the community land trust model, have an owner occupied home that turns into a rental home. Now, with the new uses and the selections we made in 2022, we are doing homes that are not a part of a land trust. And so as we work with those projects that have been selected, we are going to have to do the work of understanding how the obligation to the bondholders carries through and understand what are the agreements that the project needs to have with us in order to make sure that without the community land trust as the intermediary, we believe that we're setting terms that align with the housing infrastructure bonds. This is new for us. So we will just have to work that through as we work through the proposals that got funded with this selections round. Question nine. This is one I'm going to have to get back to you on because the Economic and Housing Challenge Program was created by the legislature in 1999. So we have staff compiling information, some of it back when we were still on paper. And we will be getting you a follow-up to that. But this one is just going to take us a little while because the timeline is so far back. So question number 10. So the question is around what percentage of total housing infrastructure bonds were spent on single family and manufactured homes or manufactured home parks. So as I walked through back in question number one and two, like when housing infrastructure bonds changed in terms of eligible use really impacts a lot of this. So for single family homes, let's see, the proceeds for loans or grants for homeownership use was limited to specific costs early on, like land acquisition, demolition, and utility connections until 2020. So total selections in community land trusts were 5.3 million between 2012 and 2020, which was 1.3% of the total housing infrastructure bonds selected. Housing infrastructure bond use was limited in 2020. Single family selections, given the late authorization, you'll remember that was the October bonding bill, and the new and expanded use. And then the 2020 RFP opened in April and closed in July, and selections were made in December of 2020. In 2020, 2.9 million in housing infrastructure bonds were processed. And then in our most recent RFP, it's 5.3 million. And where I'm giving you all these specific years and dollar amounts, we'll follow up in writing with those for you. On the manufactured home and manufactured home communities, this particular use was added in 2019. Prior to that, they weren't an eligible use. So we, in the 2020 manufactured home community infrastructure RFP, we included a selection that included $600,000 in housing infrastructure bond proceeds. And that was an RFP that combined the housing infrastructure bond use plus the appropriated program. So less than 1% prior to 2021 selections of the total housing infrastructure bonds were allocated to manufactured housing. In 2021, the agency selected $7.5 million for manufactured home communities, including $5.2 million with the housing infrastructure bonds. In that RFP, that manufactured home community RFP, we selected about 80% of the proposals. I think if I can just with commentary here, we agree that we need to do more around homeownership development. And I'll note that the governor is recommending a historic amount of ongoing and dedicated resources for single family development, specifically single family development in the workforce and affordable homeownership program. It's an increase of $36 million that the governor is proposing over 3 years for this program. And I think, as I noted before, using housing infrastructure bonds for single family development has some financing complexities that the appropriated programs don't, which make it easier for developers, especially smaller developers that are doing this around the state. Any questions there from the committee?
Members, any questions for the commissioner? I'm not seeing any, commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not as good at multitasking on my screen to know when there's a hand up. Thank you. Question 11, do we do follow-up on projects if a project is funded with an intention of providing affordable housing at 30% of area median income? Do we follow up later to make sure that teams are being met? So for rental developments funded with agency resources, the agency undertakes regular monitoring to ensure that there is compliance with applicable terms and requirements, including income limits. The exact form of the monitoring can differ depending on the program, but it often includes file reviews, income documentation, certifications from developers, and may include periodic inspections of the development. We have a compliance structure in place to take appropriate action when non-compliance is discovered. On to question 12. We're in ongoing conversations with both our developer and our local community partners on the issue. The two initiatives that passed last fall are very different. To date, we're not aware of an actual policy under consideration by the city of Minneapolis. That said, we're aware of the early discussions of the initiative that passed in St. Paul in both developments that are planned and developments that are underway. None of our partner developers that we have funded have given back awards because of the rent control discussions. And federal and state subsidies have agreements around the income levels of the people who the homes are made available for, and rules around the setting of rents. So that comes with getting federal or state assistance. In my discussions with the city, I think that they're looking at what they can do to address the ongoing issue of housing being unaffordable to people who earn the least. I'm tracking those conversations. And in the meantime, the governor and lieutenant governor proposed significant investments to address the supply shortage and to build homes for people having the hardest time making rent. So I'm eager to work with you on that. To question 13, on the modeling, none of the developers we've recently selected for financing in St. Paul have reached out to us with concerns. I'll just reiterate that the multifamily properties that we finance in these communities already include limitations on rent increases. We are the public subsidy. I think this conversation is largely about, the vast majority of the housing market, which is a private market venture.
So, Commissioner, there's been no talk of increasing fundings for any properties in Minneapolis or St. Paul. Have you studied the kind of the before and after of requests or anything like that?
Chairman, what we know best are the projects that we have investments in. And of the projects that we have investments in, nobody has said we don't want to do the project anymore. But as I said, when we make the investment, the developer has already agreed to make the housing affordable and keep the housing affordable. That's what we do. We will certainly be...
I think, you know, what I guess what I was getting at, affordable for who, you know, the taxpayers or the developer. You know, if the math doesn't work, the math doesn't work. You know, and if you're subsidizing it and taking away from other projects and other communities that are trying their best to handle their housing difficulties, you know, it's not fair for the 890 other cities in the state if we're pouring more resources into two communities that are hurting the capacity issue that we're facing. So anyway, we can talk about that offline, but I'm just curious if you know numbers in regards to that or no difference. It's probably too early to tell.
Thank you, Chairman Dreheim. I mean, Minneapolis doesn't have a specific policy. They are in the beginning of a conversation about what one would look like. And the St. Paul has a specific policy, but its impact is really more on private developer, 100% privately financed housing, because the housing that has, for example, federal housing tax credits or you know, HUD Home Investment Partnership dollars or any of our other dollars already has some rules that make these projects affordable over the long haul. And so this doesn't change any of the rules or I suspect patterns of our allocation of funds. But we are, you know, interested in providing data and being a part of the conversation about what the impacts are on the availability of units, development, and renters. And so we will be following that, but it's really not at the heart of what the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency does.
Thank you.
So, I mean, I guess.
They're kind of all tied together there, those questions, aren't they?
I think so. I mean, I mean, a couple things I would say to question number 14, you know, but I think I've already said it, so I don't want to be redundant. We already operate on the most affordable end of the housing spectrum. And so this just isn't something that will impact the part of the portfolio that we invest in. But we're interested in so far as we're always interested in what's happening in the whole housing market, because understanding what's happening in the whole housing market helps us understand where the investments are needed in order to address the part of the market that the private market on its own doesn't do. And that's the shortage and the cost of housing in the private market for people who make the least. So I didn't know, Chairman, if you wanted to go back over questions 15 and 16, or since we covered those in other hearings, whether we would stop at 14 today.
You know, I agree 100%. I think we did touch on that, and we can, you know, take the rest offline. But I do think there is a couple questions in the room here. So I'm going to go to Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you again, Commissioner. It's a heck of a lot of questions to power through, so we appreciate you doing that. I want to follow up to some of the questions I asked around question number 5. If you could just help me understand or give me an example of if a lot of these loans are either forgivable or zero interest loans, how is it that the agency would end up with a sum like $3 million back? Just help me understand how some of that money would make its way back to the agency, if you will, just so I can have that kind of context regarding this. Thank you.
Commissioner?
Chairman and Senator Duckworth, I would love to bring my chief financial officer in to talk through all of the nuances of this. But I think, you know, what's really important to understand is that there are many different ways in which the agency's dollars are built into deals. And the vast majority of our investments are in these longer term affordability deals. But there are instances where a small portion would come back, and then that's tracked, and it's tracked against the bondholder obligations of the specific bond issuance that is generating these things. And because of that obligation to the bondholders, it's recycled into similar purposes. I think the nuance of that, you would be better served by my sending a, it's all tied to the way that this money interplays with the federal housing tax credit and kind of the different nuances of that. So I think that it's very rare that it's near term. It's usually when the developer is requesting something specific in order to fully leverage like the 4% low income housing tax credit.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Sorry. We do have a follow-up, Senator Duckworth.
Thank you. Fair enough, Commissioner. Totally understand that you might need to do a little digging to find out how or in which ways that money might be coming back. A follow-on question to that would be, if you have somebody at the agency look into that, would be, I'd be curious to know if there are any patterns or trends on who that money typically tends to be coming back from. Any counties in particular, any sort of projects in particular where those funds seem to come back, and what that reason might be. So just to follow up, just something to note that we can maybe touch on in the future. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Chairman and Senator Duckworth, I just want to be clear. It's just an area where I have technicians that can speak to the very complex technical interplay between these dollars and the federal tax credits and deals. So it's information that's available, but words that would best come out of somebody else's mouth because it's a very technical piece. And it's
I appreciate that, Commissioner. And we totally understand that we can get people in here maybe at another hearing. But I just going to have one. We have a minute left, so I'm sorry to cut you off. Just want to make sure that no one else had any questions other than Senator Duckworth. I really appreciate your time. Once again, Commissioner, you've been more than generous. So we'll work with Joel on maybe having your people come in and visit with us on some more details on Senator Duckworth's question and a couple other maybe of the finance questions that Senator Rosen had. But with that, members, if I don't have any other questions, I am going to adjourn for the day. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Thank you, Chairman.